You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
Well, in Matthew chapter 24, 15, the Olivet Discourse starts to come down from the general overview kind of a situation that we discovered and then discussed last time into some specifics. And you remember that the disciples had asked him three questions when he said not one stone of the temple will be left standing on another. And they asked him, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? And so we've talked about when will this happen, because we went over to the Luke passage last week or last time, and we looked at the Luke's rendering of this discussion. Luke included the destruction of the temple in 70 AD in part of his account of the Olivet Discourse. And so we know what happened in 70 AD, and we know that Jesus prophesied how it would happen, and we know it happened just the way he said it would. So now we're left with the two future questions. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And in starting in verse 15 of Matthew 24, he begins to deal with these specific end time signs. And so let's read verse 15. When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Verse 17, let no one on the roof of the house go down to take anything out of the house. And verse 18, let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. Verse 19, how dreadful it will be in those days for the pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. And then verse 21, for then there will be great distress or great tribulation, some translations read, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. All right, let's stop there. And so here's the sign. When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel. And so right away, we got to go back and see what the prophet Daniel said. And it happens to be in chapter 9, verse 27. And it's right at the very end of a passage that's called Daniel's 70th week. And verse 27 of chapter 9 says, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. And in the middle of that 7, he'll put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he'll set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Well, the he of verse 27, the pronoun there, the personal pronoun, refers back to the nearest personal noun, which is the ruler of the people who will come. So the prince or ruler of the people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary in 70 AD, who are the Romans, the Roman people at the end of the age will bring forth from out of the Roman people, will come forth this ruler. We know him as the Antichrist, and this is one of his introductory verses, if you will. He is the one who will come and confirm a covenant with, it should read, the many. Some of your Bibles leave out that article. He doesn't confirm a covenant with many. He confirms a covenant with the many, which is a euphemism for Israel, for 1 7. And that 7 is a 7-year period that happens to be the last 7 years of the 490-year prophecy that's contained in Daniel 9, 24 through 27 that we know as Daniel's 70 weeks. Okay, the 70-week prophecy was a 490-year period, 70 times 7, each week being a week of years, and so 70 years times 7 equals 490 years. 483 years into that, he has told us, the Messiah will come, but when he does, he'll be executed before receiving any of the messianic promise. And then this ruler will come and confirm a covenant with Israel for that last 7 years. Now, what Daniel didn't say, because he probably wasn't alerted to this fact, is that there would be a big stretch of time between the end of the 69th week and the beginning of the 70th week. And that stretch of time is about 2,000 years, and it is nicely filled by the age of the church. You'll find these gaps throughout the Old Testament. We've talked about this before. There are 24 of them. This is one of them. And each of these gaps is about 2,000 years long, and each one really has a parenthetical pause in the middle of it into which the church fits. One of those gaps, by the way, you've already received on a Christmas card this year. It's Isaiah 9:6, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders." And you know how the verse goes. Well, you know there's a 2,000-year gap in the middle of that verse. The son was given, the child was born, but the government has not yet been on his shoulders, nor has he brought in the everlasting peace and righteousness that that verse calls for. And so there's been a gap there. We're still waiting for the rest of Daniel 9:6 to be fulfilled. Only the first two things. The son was given, the child was born. And so that's another one of these 24 gaps you'll find in prophecy in the Old Testament into which the church can be inserted. We won't get into all of them because that would take even more time than we have tonight. But we will mention the fact that this Daniel 70-week prophecy has one of those 24 gaps in it. And so the length of time from the end of the 483rd year to the beginning of that last 7 years is the age of the church. And so when Daniel 9:27 says he'll confirm a covenant with many, that begins that 7-week period. In the middle of it, it says he'll put an end to the sacrifice and offering. Now that tells us something, because it tells us that that 7-year period, one of the things apparently contained in that covenant is the permission or authority, or however you want to phrase it, to build the temple in Israel. Because it says in the middle of it, he puts an end to the sacrifice and offering by setting up an abomination to cause a desolation on the wing of the temple. And so the temple has to be built. There isn't one here today. That's why we know that we're not in that last 7 years yet. Some people think we are. Some people think that last 7 years has already started and we're already seeing the early signs of that tribulation period that Jesus called for. Well, it can't be, because that requires a temple to be built in Israel.
And that temple has to be on the mount?
Well, that's a matter of opinion. I carefully say it has to be in Israel, because I don't think it will be on the Temple Mount. I think that when you read Ezekiel's instructions, or the instructions that Ezekiel gave, that God gave through him, I should say, for the building of the temple, and you look at the allocation of land, you'll find out that the Temple Mount is in the wrong place for the new temple. The new temple will be built just north of there, in my opinion, in a place called Shiloh, which is in the West Bank today. And that's the place where the tabernacle stood for 400 years when they first came to Israel. If you want to know more about that, look on our website. There's an article there called The Coming Temple. And it tells all about it, tells all the background, gives you all the detail as to why I believe. And I'm not the only one, by the way. This has been around for a long time, and several leading prophecy scholars of the day also believe that the temple will be built somewhere other than the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Okay, and so there is the reference that Jesus made. He said, the abomination that causes desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Now, we talked a little bit about this last time, but I want to go into it again with you because of the fact that we're right now in the season. You know, the festival of Hanukkah began 2 nights ago, and it runs for 8 days. And the festival of Hanukkah is a remembrance, if you will, a memorial to the rededication of the temple in 165 BC, when it was defiled by a Syrian ruler named Antiochus IV. He called himself Theos Epiphanes, which means God made manifest. And so his name in history became Antiochus Epiphanes, but he's really Antiochus IV. About 160 8 or so, he broke into the temple grounds for the second or third time and erected a statue of the Greek god Zeus there in the holy place, which is also the Roman god Jupiter, by the way. So if you read about this and some say, no, it wasn't Zeus, it was Jupiter, they're the same guy. Okay, so in Rome, he was called Jupiter. In Greek, he was called Zeus. But Antiochus put his own face on this, on the statue, put it in the holy place, and required people to come and worship it. He effectively turned the temple into a pagan worship center. He boiled a pork in water, and instead of sprinkling blood of bulls and goats of the sacrifices in the holy place, he had his people sprinkle this water that had pork boiled in it. He sacrificed pigs on the altar, and he required that the Jews submit to this and accept this and worship him as God. And of course, some rebelled. Notably, a family of Judas Maccabeus is his real name. We know him as Judah the Hammer. He started the Maccabean Revolt, 3.5-year revolt, threw the Syrians out of Israel, reestablished Israel's independence. They tore the statue, of course, out of the holy place, ground it to powder, and threw it in the river that ran down east of the temple there, the Brook Kidron, it's called. They took the altar that he had slaughtered the pigs on, tore it apart, built a new altar, and rededicated the temple. When it came time to, one of the steps in the dedication process is burning the menorah, the 7-branch candlestick, in the temple for 8 days. And on the 8th day, that cleanses it. When they have to burn it for 8 days straight, they have to use a special recipe of oil that God gave them. You read about it in the book of Exodus when they went to the storerooms because of the fact that the temple had been ransacked and all the treasure taken. They found that there's only 1 day's worth of oil. There was only enough oil to burn for 1 day. And there was not enough time to make a new batch in time to complete the dedication ceremony. And so they decided to burn the 1 day's worth of oil, hoping that God would find that sufficient because that's really all they had. Well, he miraculously allowed the oil to burn for the full 8 days. And that's how the Feast of Hanukkah became to be an 8-day festival. Every day they light a candle on a 9-branch Hanukkah menorah called the Hanukkiah. The one branch that stands up above it is called the Shemash, it's the servant branch, and that candle is lit first. And then each day of Hanukkah, one of the other candles is lit from it. So on the first day, you light one. On the second day, you light two. On the third day, you light three, and so forth. So you have on the 8th day, you light all 8 of the candles. So there's really 9 candles burning, the Shemash, the servant candle, plus the 8, one for each day. And so the Jewish people are in the middle of that celebration now. And they give gifts and do things and it's becoming more and more like Christmas is. It's becoming in many, especially Reformed families, it's becoming like the Jewish version of Christmas. And it happens right around Christmas time. Depending on the year, of course, the Jewish year is a little different than ours, so it can vary by almost 2 weeks from year to year. But this year, it started at sundown on December 15th. And runs, so we're in the Hanukkah celebration. You won't find anything about it in the Bible because it wasn't instituted until 165 BC. You'll find it in the Book of Maccabees, which is in the apocryphal books, not included in our Bible. But 1 Maccabees, the first few chapters, tells all about the festival of Hanukkah. It's good reading, by the way, and it would be a good thing for you to read because there's a very... there's a very close parallel in symbolism between the Maccabean Revolt and the Great Tribulation. In fact, my current article on the website takes you through the history of Hanukkah and the history of the Maccabean Revolt, how it started, how it came to be, how long it lasted, what happened during it. And it gives you a pretty good history lesson on the Maccabean Revolt. And then it compares it to the Great Tribulation. Because what I want you to see here, I didn't want to get into a whole study on Maccabean Revolt and Hanukkah and so on. But what I do want you to see is this happened, this abomination of desolation that Daniel wrote about took place in 165 BC. It's the only time it's ever happened. And yet Jesus in Matthew 24:15 told the people to look forward to this. And of course, he was speaking in 32 AD, about 200 years after it had already happened in history. And he's saying one of the signs that the end of the age is upon us is that abomination of desolation. Now, he's not telling them to look back at it. He's telling them to look forward to it. And I believe the reason that he mentions it specifically, I also believe the reason that it only happened once is because it's a clear model, if you will, preview of what will begin the Great Tribulation at the end of the age. Because you'll have a temple, just like you did back then. You'll have somebody who becomes a very powerful world ruler, just like Antiochus was. He will stand in the temple and proclaim himself to be God, just like Antiochus did. According to 2 Thessalonians 2:4, Paul says he will stand in the holy place and declare himself to be God, which means he'll demand worship. He'll exalt himself, Paul says, above everything that's worshipped or called God. And then he will begin a persecution of the Jews, just like Antiochus did. He will persecute them with the intent of obliterating them from the face of the earth, just like Antiochus did. This severe persecution will last for 3.5 years, just like the Maccabean Revolt lasted for 3.5 years. At the end of it, the ruler will be defeated, just like the Antichrist will be defeated. The temple was rededicated and put to use again, just like I believe the temple will be rededicated and put to use again at the end of the age and will become the millennial temple for Israel during the so-called kingdom age, what we call the millennium. And so there's an incredible amount of repeated action in there. It's almost like the Maccabean Revolt was a dress rehearsal on a local level for the Great Tribulation, which will take place on a world level. The question was, the rapture occurs after the Antichrist has been revealed. I don't think so. I think that that the Antichrist will be revealed after the church is gone. In fact, I think one of the things that prevents him being revealed is the presence of the church.
And I think some people rely on that.
They do. That's the moment of truth. That's when they say, well, okay, I got to make up my mind now because there's the Antichrist. No, I don't think that'll happen that way. And if you know the sort of the mindset of the Jewish people, it helps to put this in perspective but only a small minority of people in Israel today are in favor of building a temple. Most people don't want anything to do with it. They can't agree on where to put it. They know that there would never be a suitable place for the rest of the world. No matter where they decide to put it, the rest of the world would have a fit about it. About 3/4 of the people living in Israel are not observant Jews. They're not religious Jews. They're biological Jews. They're Jewish by birth, yes, not by religion. And so only about 1 out of 4 Jewish people follows the Jewish religion. Most of them are secular humanists, agnostics. And so nobody wants a temple, because they know what they would set off a war, basically, if they started to build one. So first thing that has to happen is somehow that perspective has to be changed. They have to demand that they want a temple, regardless of all the mess it would make. And so in order for them to do that, something has to happen for them to be called back into the covenant relationship with God. And the thing that causes that, in my opinion, is the battle of Ezekiel 38-39. Turn with me just for a minute to Ezekiel 39. This is bonus material. It won't be on the final exam. But it's interesting stuff to look at. Ezekiel chapter 39. 38 and 39, describe this coming battle between Israel and a coalition of what we now call Muslim nations. And I'll just pick out the end of it here from verse 22. The Lord says, at the end of this battle, he says, from that day forward, the house of Israel will know that I am the Lord their God. Okay. Ezekiel 39:22. So from the end of this battle of Ezekiel, from that day forward, the house of Israel will know that I'm the Lord their God. All right. They don't know that now. That's not an official position of theirs. They would deny that officially. But it says that from this battle, from that time on, they will know this. And the nations, verse 23, will know that the people of Israel went into exile for their sin because they were unfaithful to me. So I hid my face from them and handed them over to their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. I dealt with them according to their uncleanness. And then verse 25, I will now bring Jacob back from captivity and have compassion on all the people of Israel, and they will be zealous for my holy name. They'll forget their shame and all the unfaithfulness they showed, and on it goes. And then you get down to verse 28. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God, for although I sent them into exile among the nations, I will gather them to their own land, not leaving any behind. And so that gathering actually started in 1948. But still, there are as many Jews outside of Israel as there are in Israel. And so only about half of the Jews alive today live in Israel. Most of the other half lives here in the U.S. But he says, after this battle, they will all know. Now, to me, that means they will be back in a relationship with God because of the miraculous way in which he wins this battle on their behalf. They won't be able to attribute their victory to anything other than his direct intervention against their enemies. Now, as soon as they come back into a relationship with God, that means they're back into their covenant with God, and their covenant requires a temple. They don't meet Jesus here. They come back to an old covenant standing with God, and they require a temple in order to worship him. They can't worship him according to the old covenant provisions without a temple. The way in which they worship him today is not consistent with what the Lord gave them. It's a setup that was initiated in Babylon by Ezekiel, by the way, the synagogue form of worship initiated by Ezekiel. But even he included provisions for the annual cleansing from their sins, the Yom Kippur celebration, which they haven't been able to do since the temple disappeared in 70 AD. There's not a single Jew alive on earth today that is ceremonially clean. None of them can approach God. And they can't do that until they have a temple. And so this battle opens their eyes to him, brings them back into an old covenant relationship. Basically, he picks them up where they left off. In Zechariah, toward the end of Zechariah, I think it's in chapter 12, we learn that toward the end of the Great Tribulation, they come to the conclusion that Jesus is their Messiah. And before the second coming, they recognize him as their Messiah, and that's what allows them to dwell with him in the kingdom age. But the first thing they do is come back into relationship with God the Father, into that old covenant relationship they enjoyed back in biblical times. I believe the church may see some of this battle. I think the battle is coincidental. The rapture of the church is coincidental, concurrent with this battle. Because Acts chapter 15 and Romans chapter 11 tell us that when the full number, Romans 11, 25 says, when the full number of the churches come in, then the hardening of the hearts that the Jewish people have experienced will go away and their eyes will be opened. Now, when the full number of the churches come in, we get raptured. And so one of the things that happens at the rapture is the eyes of the Jews are opened again. Their hearts are softened toward him. Acts 15 says that back in the 55 AD, I think it was, maybe a little earlier than that, when at the Council of Jerusalem, when James, the brother of Jesus, was asked this question, does a Gentile have to become a Jew before he can become a Christian? And James said, no, a Gentile can come straight into the church. And the next question was, well, if that's the case, what's going to happen to Israel? Aren't we supposed to be the front door for the kingdom? And what James said is that God, for his own purposes, is gathering together a people for his name's sake from among the Gentiles. A people for his name's sake. We're called by his name. We're called Christian. He says, after that, he'll return and build David's fallen tabernacle. He's referring to the temple. So after he has taken from among the Gentiles a people for himself, taken them for himself, then he'll return and rebuild the temple. And so Romans 11:25, Acts 15:15, both say that once the Lord turns his focus back on Israel, the church disappears. And so the last thing we see may be part of this Ezekiel battle. I don't think we'll be here for any more than that. That's why Christians look at the Middle East so carefully and get kind of excited every time somebody like Iran or Syria or somebody like that pops up and says, we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, because they know that that's part of the Ezekiel 38 scenario. And so that's when I believe you'll see the rapture. Before the 70th week begins, that Daniel 70th week, I think, is kicked off immediately following Ezekiel 38, 39. The rapture of the church happens at the same time. Then comes the 70th week. And then comes chapters 6 through 19 of the book of Revelation. Okay, so then Jesus tells them to look forward to this abomination. Now here, again, let me repeat this. I said that the abomination of desolation only happened once in history. And I believe the reason it only happened once in history is so that people on earth, when it happens again, will be able to recognize it. I've seen opinions from theologians that say there have been lots of abominations of desolation, and I don't believe it. I believe it was a single event. I believe there's only been one event called by that name, and that event requires a man to stand in the temple and proclaim himself to be God and require that he be worshipped as God. I think that, I know that's what happened in 168 BC. I believe that is what has to happen in the abomination. We talked about this last time, that when Rome hung their eagle on the wall outside the main gate of the temple, that did not fulfill the requirements of the abomination of desolation. That was in 70 AD. When the Roman emperors demanded they be worshipped as gods, that did not equal the abomination of desolation, because they didn't do it in the temple in Jerusalem. We talked last time about the fact that a couple of them tried it. Caligula tried to have his statue brought in. And by the way, that was correct last time. I did have that right. He is the emperor that tried to get his statue put in the temple, and it failed. He died before he could pull it off. He was assassinated, as a matter of fact, before he could pull it off. Nero tried the same thing and didn't get there. No one has, and of course, then in 70 AD the temple was destroyed. Nobody's had a chance to do that in the meantime. So there's been one abomination of desolation, was Antioch Epiphanes. He's the model, if you will. He's the type. And because he is unique in history, he becomes an unmistakable sign for the future. Nobody can say, well, there's been so many of these, how do we know this is the one? Because there's only been one. So it's unmistakable. And Jesus says, when that happens, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, this is one of those things that tells us, this is verse 16, this is one of those things that tells us that he's talking to Jewish people. Because the people who live in Judea was the first century name for Israel, those are the people who are to flee in the mountains. It's not people in Salt Lake City or in Las Vegas or in Denver or in New York City. It's not none of those places. It's the people who live in Judea. Now, today, Judea and Samaria make up the West Bank. So if you want the biblical name for the West Bank, it's Judea and Samaria. And so it's the area around Jerusalem and just to the north and east. Central Israel, if you will. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of it. Let no one in the field go back and take it. What he means by that is leave now, immediately. When you see this, leave immediately. Now, of course, how would they see it? Well, today they can, because today we can see religious ceremonies all over the world from the comfort of our own homes, right? And so cable TV, the internet, things like this make it possible for us today to see things in life, live as they're happening. CNN will be there, yes. And so he says, when you see this, get out of town. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women nursing mothers, because it'll be such a strain on them, of course. Pray that your flight not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. Now, this is a verse, by the way, that you can use to prove that God answers prayers and that prayer changes things. I had a question like that on the website. Somebody said, how can you prove? How can you know for sure that God answers prayer and that prayer changes things? And I gave him this verse. I said, this verse proves it. He says, pray that your flight not take place on the Sabbath. In other words, he's saying, these things are going to happen. The end of the age is going to come. There is going to be an abomination of desolation. But you have some input here. You can pray that it doesn't take place on the Sabbath or in the wintertime. Now, there's two good reasons there. The Sabbath, they're only allowed to walk 1,000 paces. And so they can take 1,000 steps, and that's all. It's about a third of a mile. That's as far as they can go. And in history, Jews have been cut down in their tracks, being chased on the Sabbath. And when they took that 1,000th step, they stopped and died, because they'd rather die than break the law. And that's why they pray that it doesn't take place on the Sabbath. Only the Jews have that prohibition. This is another reason why you know this has to be written to Jewish people, because we wouldn't care. We'd run 100 miles on the Sabbath if we could get away. Wouldn't matter to us. We're not prohibited from doing that. They are. Pray that it not take place in the winter. It's hard to be outside in the wintertime around Judea, because although north of there in the Galilee, they grow bananas because it's subtropical, and down by the Dead Sea, it's warm all the time. But in Jerusalem, they're 3,700 feet above sea level. It's cold there in the winter. And being outside at night in the wintertime out in the field with no protection would be difficult. And it says you don't have time to go back to even get your coat. So pray that it doesn't happen in the winter, because that would be difficult for you. Verse 21 says, for then there will be great distress or great tribulation, unequal from the beginning of the world until now, never to be equaled again. And so he coined the period of time that up until then had been known as the time of Jacob's trouble. He coined the phrase great tribulation. Now he says in John 16:33, he says, in this world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. That's not the same as the great tribulation. The great tribulation, he says, is a time that has been unequaled since the beginning of the world and will never be equaled again. Now think of some of the great disasters or great persecutions that have taken place since the beginning of the world. And you'll see that Jesus was not talking about something like that when he told his church, in this world you'll have tribulation, but take heart because I've overcome the world. Not the same at all. Think, for example, of the Holocaust. That was pretty big, pretty dramatic. 6 million Jews and 3 million others, undesirables. 9 million people. How about Stalin when he took over Russia and consolidated into the Soviet Union? 40 million people slaughtered. Huge. What about Noah? What about Noah? I'm building up as I go here.
Sorry.
What about Noah? Only 8 people survived. And he says, this will be worse than any of that. So you see, he's not just talking about persecution for people. He's talking about something that's worse than anything that's ever happened in history, and it's so bad that it will never, ever be repeated. And then in the very next verse says, he says, if those days had not been cut short, nobody would survive it. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. Now that's a hard verse to translate. You see, the Bible very clearly identifies the length of the Great Tribulation. Very clearly. It's the most clearly identified span of time in all of Scripture. It's given in some places as 3.5 years. Another place it's given as 42 months. Another place it's given as 1260 days. And of course, if you're using God's 30-day, 12-month calendar, 360-day year, like the world originally had, then all three of those are the same span of time. 3.5 years equals 42 months, which equals 1,260 days. And so it's a very clearly identified period of time. And so what does he mean here if those days had not been cut short? What the passage means is that if he didn't stop it at the appointed time, if he just let it continue to its ultimate conclusion, there wouldn't be a single human being left alive. But for the sake of the elect, he's going to stop it at its appointed time so that some people survive it. But it will be bad enough and severe enough that if he didn't, nobody would survive it. So that's how serious this is. In verse 23, he says, at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. Verse 24, for false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, he says, I've told you ahead of time. So this confirms, again, he's looking into the future with things like this. So he says, one of the signs of the end of the age will be false messiahs. People coming, preaching false gospel. People coming, not just one, but several, coming and saying that they are the Messiah when they're not. He says this will be characteristic of that time. And some of them, he says, will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect. And of course, Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that one of the characteristics of the Antichrist and his false prophets will be miracles that will deceive those who are perishing. And they're probably the best at it. Okay, let's go to verse 26, Matthew 24, 26. So he says, if anyone tells you there he is out in the desert, don't go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now this is an incredible prophecy, and one that you should be very clear about. When the Lord comes, it will be like visible to everyone, just as lightning that strikes in the east is also visible in the west. It won't be a secret. It won't be something that happens and then you hear about it later. Everyone will see this. This is another thing that distinguishes this from the rapture, because the rapture is said to be a secret event. Nobody will know about the rapture until after the fact. But everybody on earth at the time will see the second coming, which happens at the very end of the Great Tribulation, after the end of the Great Tribulation. And that's what let's read verse 28 first. Wherever there's a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Now, a lot of people try to make a big deal out of this, but to me, the simple explanation of that is, if you're walking around the desert and you look up in the sky and you see some vultures circling around, you know if you stand underneath the vultures, there will be a carcass. And this is what he's trying to say. This will be the way it is. It's visible, in other words. You can spot it. If there's a carcass, you'll see vultures in the sky. And that's what he's saying about when he comes. It'll be something you can look up in the sky and tell what's going on earth. In Isaiah 63, you've got this coming from Basra. Because Basra is where Petra is, and that's where the remnant of Jews will be hiding, and that's the group the Antichrist wants to wipe out. Because if he can, you see the deal here is, if you can wipe out the Jews, you can prevent the Lord's return. That's the whole thing about anti-Semitism. If you can wipe out the Jews, you can prevent the Lord's return. Because of a passage, Hosea 5:15 says that, and it's speaking of the Lord, he's saying, I will go back to my place from whence I came until they call for me. And in their affliction, they will call for me. And so he says that he's going away and he's not going to return until he's invited. Now, if you can wipe out the Jews, you can prevent the invitation. You want to read that? Hosea, we're far enough off the track, so this won't matter. Hosea 5:15, the Lord says, then I will go back to my place until they admit their guilt, and they will seek my face in their misery. They will earnestly seek me. And then it goes on in chapter 6, first two verses, here's what they say. They say, come, let us return to the Lord. He's torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he'll bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he'll revive us, and in the third day, he'll restore us that we may live in his presence. And of course, people who like the 1,000 years equals a day verse out of Peter say, look at that, after 2,000 years, he'll restore us. Well, that's kind of the way it's been. And in the third 1,000 years, that's the kingdom age, the millennium. And so it kind of fits there. But the idea is that in order to have him returned, they have to petition him officially. Satan wants to eliminate every last Jew from the earth. That's satanic. Because of that verse in Hosea, he can prevent the second coming that way. And so this, remember in Matthew 23, 37, the Lord said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who sent to you, how I've longed to gather you under my wings as a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you were unwilling. He says, see, your house is left to you desolate, and you will not see me again until you learn to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so that, to me, that was saying, that was a fulfillment of the first part of Hosea 5:15. I'm going back. That's what he was saying to him. I'm going back where I came from. That implies he came from someplace and it is here. Now he's going back. And he says, you're not going to see me again until you learn to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Until you know who I am, you won't see me again. And to me, that was him repeating Hosea 5:15 to them. And so you see that that they have to petition his return. They have to ask him back. And so if you can kill them all off, you can prevent the second coming. That was the whole point of this. But of course, you can't. He's always preserved a remnant. He always will. Okay, and back to Matthew 24 and in verse 29. 29 says, immediately after the distress or tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. That's immediately after the end of the great tribulation. That's the first thing that's going to happen. The sun will go dark, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and it says the heavenly bodies will be shaken. The actual word in the Greek there is for bodies is dunamis, which means power, and so it really literally means the heavenly powers will be shaken. I think it's talking more about supernatural powers opposed to God. And verse 30 says, at that time, when? Immediately after the end of the great tribulation, at that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. So first thing that happens at the end of the great tribulation is the sign of the Son of Man appears in the sky. Now, people have speculated on what the sign of the Son of Man is. A lot of people think it's the cross, and so they look for a big cross to appear in the sky. It doesn't say that he will appear. It says that his sign will appear. So that's the thing that happens directly after the Great Tribulation. And that I want you to understand how important that is, because we know exactly how long the Great Tribulation is. We know that from the time of the abomination that causes desolation until the end of the Great Tribulation is 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,260 days, all the same. But that doesn't tell us that the Lord will come back on that day. It tells us that that's the day the Great Tribulation ends, and the next thing you see is his sign in the sky. Then, sometime after that, and it doesn't say how long, it says, and then they'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Now, the phrase, you won't know the day or the hour, does not apply to the rapture of the church alone. The people on earth at the end of the Great Tribulation will not know the day or the hour of his return. Because what they'll see is the sign in the sky, and then sometime later, we don't know, then will come him appearing in the sky. But you will not be able to tell the day of the second coming, like a lot of people teach, by counting from the abomination of cause of desolation, 1260 days, and there he comes. You will not be able to do that. And as we go further into Matthew 24, you'll see that he says that several times. And this is one of the reasons that some people look at the last half of Matthew 24 and say, well, he's talking about the rapture of the church because it says you don't know the day or the hour. And everybody will know the day and the hour of his coming because it's 1260 days after the abomination. Not true. Not true. Not the people in the rapture, nor the people at the end of the Great Tribulation will know in advance the day or hour of his coming. The difference is when he comes for the church in secret, we leave the earth and go to heaven. When he comes at the second coming, he comes to earth and the people stay where they are. So you see, it's the exact opposite direction. What happens in the rapture is people disappear from earth. What happens in the second coming is the Lord appears on earth. It's the opposite. People stay where they are. Now that's going to be very important as we read through the rest of Matthew 24, because when he says things like, as it was in the day of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Well, did a whole bunch of people disappear off the face of the earth? No. The floods came and swept them away, but they didn't vanish off the earth. They were judged on the earth, just like it will be in the Great Tribulation. You have to read the fine print, you have to read every word, and you have to understand clearly what he's trying to say here, because there's been so much false teaching about this. There is no indication anywhere in the Olivet Discourse of any kind of rapture of a church, because it's given to Israel. It's given to Jews. It was not given to the church. Just because it's in the Gospels doesn't mean it's for the church. This is a prophecy given by a Jewish prophet to Jewish people about Jewish times at the end of the age. Period. Church is not involved here at all. You have to be clear about that, because there have been more mistakes in interpreting Matthew 24 because Christians thinking it's in the Gospels, it's said by Jesus, must apply to the church. Not necessarily true. We'll get to some of that in just a minute. So let's read on. They'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Now look at verse 31. And he'll send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they'll gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. All right, now if you didn't know about the rapture, you wouldn't see it in that verse. But because you know about it, now you see it. And so you can't use that verse to verify the rapture, in my opinion, because if you didn't know it already, you wouldn't be able to use it as proof, right? You'd say he'll gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Okay, that means from everywhere. Well, it doesn't. It means from heaven. Now, he's coming to earth, and he's on his way. They'll look up in the sky, and they'll see him coming in the clouds with power and great glory. And as he does, he'll send angels out to gather his elect from all over heaven to bring them with him. That's us. That's the only hint you'll see anywhere in the Olivet Discourse that a group from earth has gone to heaven and now they're coming back. You can't build rapture doctrine on that. All you can do is verify it. He says, now learn this lesson. This is verse 32 from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. The fig tree is the last tree in the spring to get leaves. And so the Jews have a saying, when the fig tree gets leaves, you know summer's on its way. Because there'll be no more frost, there'll be no more cold, because the fig tree does not blossom. Its branches don't even get tender enough to produce leaves until all the winter cold has passed. So when the fig tree gets leaves, summer's right around the corner. He's saying, when you see these things happen, abomination that causes desolation, all these false Christs, great tribulation. He says, when you see this begin to take place, you know that the second coming is the next event. That's all that says. Now, verse 34 is a good one, and this might be our last one. But at least we got down to a few more verses, didn't we? Verse 34, I tell you the truth, he says, this generation will not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Generation. When you look this up in the Greek, there's no question about it. It means a generation of people. And so there are three possibilities, because generation can also mean race. In general application, the word genea, from which we get generation, can also mean a race of people. So here are the three possible interpretations of this passage. The first one is this. When he says this generation, he's talking about the generation of people alive when he was in 32 AD. And he's saying, you guys will not die until you see all this happen. Well, the preterists, who believe that all prophecy was fulfilled by 70 AD, look at this verse and say, well, that proves it. He's talking to people who were alive then. It all happened during their lifetimes. It's over. I just want you to know that. They believe that. Now, I don't believe it, and I think it's pretty easily disproved, but that's one of their views. Okay, so that's one view. That's the preterist view. The second view is that he was talking about the Jewish people in time. When he says this generation will not pass away, and they use the interpretation of genea as being this race of people. The Jewish people will not disappear until all this has been fulfilled. Well, that's true. They haven't. There's been all kinds of attempts to wipe them out, none of them successful. There were Jews there then, there were Jews here now, and there are Jews all the way in between. And so, in a sense, that's true. And people who take the non-literal approach to end times prophecies say, well, that's what that verse means. It just means the Jewish people will always be around. God will protect his people and keep them all the way to the end of the age. And the third generation is that the way the passage literally reads is that by this generation, he means the generation alive when these things are happening. He's in the future talking about all this stuff. And what he's saying is the generation of people alive when this is happening will not pass away until it's happened. In other words, it'll happen within the lifespan of a single generation of people. And that's the view I have subscribed to, that he was in the future and he's talking about this future generation. He's saying, if you're in Judea at the end of the age, when you see the signs, flee into the mountains. That's the generation. The same generation that has to flee into the mountains then will still be alive when all the prophecies fulfilled. But here's the thing I really want you to see here. A lot of teaching, especially by pre-trib teachers, has taken this to mean that all end times prophecy has to be fulfilled within the span of a generation. And that's not true. And that's not what he said. Because a generation is nominally 40 years. It's taken as the definition of a generation is the time span between the birth of a man and the birth of his first son. Throughout biblical history, if you average it all up, it comes out to just about 40 years. And so they say, well, that means that it all has to happen within 40 years. And so they look at the events of the end times, and they say, the first thing they say is, well, this all concerns Israel, but there wasn't any Israel from about 135 AD till about 1948. And so if it all has to happen within a 40-year generation, then you take 1948 and you add 40 years to it, and you get 1988, and some very famous and very well-known prophecy teachers prior to 1988 pegged the rapture as coming in 1988. I don't think that happened. At least I hope it didn't happen. Because I missed it if it did. And by the way, so did all those teachers. None of them went in 1988 either. So they're probably willing to admit they were wrong. But see, that's the problem when you don't read it carefully, because it doesn't say that things will have to happen within the span of a generation. It says things have to happen within the lifetimes of a generation of people. And that's different because what that means is people who are being born about the time when these things start to happen will still be alive, many of them, when this is all done. This passage doesn't say it'll all happen within a generation. It says it'll happen within the lives of the generation of people being born when these signs begin. Now, what's a lifespan? Well, according to Psalm 90, verse 10, it's 70 years. And so if you're a date setter and you want to start figuring out when all this is going to happen, you can't start with 40 years. You got to start with 70 years. And you can count from 70 years from 1948, and you get 2018. That's about 12 years from now. Now, that doesn't mean the rapture will happen in 2018, by the way. It means if that's the date you pick, you're saying all end times prophecy will be fulfilled before 2018, including the second coming. The rapture has to happen at least 7 years before the second coming, and maybe more. But it has to happen at least 7 years before the second coming. So you take 18 and minus 7, now you're on to 11. And we're at 06, almost 07. Okay, but you get this point now. This passage, this verse, does not stipulate that all end times prophecies have to occur within a generation, a 40-year generation. The passage says they have to be fulfilled within the lifetimes of the generation being born when they begin. That's what the passage implies. If the beginning is 48, which is speculative, then you add 70 years to 48, if 70 years is a lifetime. And if that happens, then we're looking at everything happening by 2018. Now, other people look at Luke 21 that says, Jerusalem was trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And of course, Jerusalem was not a Jewish city again until 1967. So people add 70 years to 1967 and they get 2037. And so what I've done is say, okay, that's close enough. There's a window for you. 2018 to 2037. Everything has to happen, can happen as early as 18, as late as 37. But the rapture can happen today, because it's not connected to any other end time event. That's a good place for us to stop. I just wanted you to get those few points about this. Next time when we get together, we'll be speaking about this concept of nobody knows the day or the hour. That'll take us through the rest of chapter 24.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.